podcast this week, we finally answered the question, glass? Who gives a shit about glass? Well, we do, especially when that glass is Rose Glass, director of Love Lies Bleeding. Plus, we hatch a lucrative business plan with the star of The Fall Guy, Winston Duke. All that plus usual news and nonsense on the movie podcast that can't stop thinking about challengers. Not the sexy bits. More the fact that they called the new Luca Guadagnino movie Challengers, and not Bomby by your game, Bomby, Bomby, Bomby by your game, oh yeah! Oh yes, folks. Hello, pod. I'm Chris Hewitt. Welcome to the Empire Podcast. Don't shake your head at me, Helen O'Hara.
Recycling your own Twitter jokes.
I'm workshopping on Twitter, and I'm delivering the coup de grace here.
Yeah.
If you will. If you will. Hello, pod. I'm Chris Hewitt. Welcome to the Empire Podcast. I'm joined in the pod booth this week. I'm speaking quickly because we've had a bit of a snafu and we don't have a lot of time to record this week's podcast, folks. I'm joined by my three colleagues of such lethal cunning. Helen O'Hara, our geek queen. You have already heard her gushing praise for my rendition of Ball Me By Your Game, the new Christmas number one, double A side with Call Me By Your Name. We're also joined by our great big fucking nerd, James Dyer. Hello, James Dyer.
Hello, Chris.
Excellent stuff, James. Well done. And returning to the revolving fourth chair, the star of Gladiators. Can you feel the power of Kobe Amanaka? It's Kobe Amanaka.
Thanks. A great intro as always, guys. Thank you very much.
I was like, wait, is he in Gladiator 2? Is that what you're trying to get at?
You should be in Gladiator 2, Kobe.
I've been speaking with Ridley. He said no, but I'm going to be there.
But you're speaking to him.
Yeah, exactly.
I like that. Because the last time Kobe was here, you revealed that you had been, well, you know, revealed, you know, if anyone follows you on social media, you're always banging on about it, but you were in Gladiators, the original Gladiators way back in the day.
Not the original, the Sky one.
Oh, the Sky, well, that's impressive. Oh, God, I thought you were on with Jet and Wolf and Rhino and stuff.
No, how old do you think I am?
75?
No, it was the Sky reboots, which kind of appeared when the last writer's strike happened. So.
Oh, for good, I was so impressed. I was telling everyone I knew the star of Gladiators, and now I'm like, why should I even bother?
I'm still on it. It's just the Sky one.
That's true. That's
the ITV one, yeah.
You're impressive, Kobe. Welcome. What brings you to London?
I'm here to see you guys. That's the whole reason. Absolutely.
Welcome, welcome, welcome. Let's get straight into it, shall we, with a listener question. Now, a quick addendum to last week's listener question, which was about the Mount Rushmore of directors' 10th films.
Oh, boy.
And even though I'd spent most of the morning putting together what I thought was a pretty fucking good list of some amazing directors and their 10th films, it turns out I'd left off a couple of people, including my old mucker, Guillermo del Toro.
Yeah.
Couldn't believe I left him off. I left off the master of animation, Hayao Miyazaki, as well. Left him off. All right. Okay, so if I tell you what Guillermo del Toro and Miyazaki made as their 10th films, would this change your mind? Okay. Mm-hmm. So Guillermo del Toro's 10th film as director is The Shape of Water, aka Fish Fucker.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm okay without that. I love Guillermo, but no.
No. Miyazaki's 10th film as director of animation is Ponyo. Does that change your mind?
No.
All right, excellent stuff. Scintillating conversation, and always a good way to start the podcast. So we stick with Mount Rushmore of directors' 10th films as they are. Good news, folks. It's Star Wars Day. Not today. It's Thursday, 2nd of May, and not tomorrow when the podcast goes out. That's Friday, 3rd of May. But it is Star Wars Day on Saturday. May the 4th be with you. May the 4th be with you, Kobe. May the 4th be with you, Helen.
I celebrate Geek Day instead, as you know.
You do. James, you must celebrate Alien Day.
Yeah, it's Alien Day. I actually passed me by this year. It wasn't until after it had elapsed that I realised what it was.
But oh no, you didn't put your alien tree up?
It's true.
Your alien
I didn't do anything like that.
You didn't burst out of someone's chest?
I hugged no faces on Alien Day.
Oh no.
But,
what about cats at least?
I'll just make up for next year. Yeah. Jonesy lives. Justice for Jones.
Did you flame through any eggs?
No.
Okay.
It's a very inefficient way to make eggs.
Alien Day, by the way, is 4/26, I believe.
Yes, as in LV 4/26.
Yeah, which does make sense.
In the UK, it would be 26/4, which makes sense.
Yeah, makes no sense whatsoever. Anyway, Star Wars Day this weekend, so I've asked people for Star Wars questions.
Oh, okay.
Because you know what? We don't often tackle Star Wars questions on this podcast, despite being big Star Wars fans and great big old geeks. So there you go.
Right, okay.
Here's one from Patrick Kottner, who is actually the producer and part of the team behind the George Lucas talk show.
Mm-hmm.
And he asks, what do you want the final Star Wars thing to be? Okay. How do you end the story forever?
I mean, is it wrong to say I just want there to be one day? I want to know that one day it will
end. One day. Yeah, yeah. But we wouldn't say that about the Marvel Cinematic Universe, Helen, now, would we?
I would. I think what? Everything should at some point come to an end and make room for new things to grow.
Including the Empire podcast.
No, obviously not that.
Obviously not.
I mean, come on.
Come on.
Ridiculous.
What are you talking about?
But no, I genuinely like the idea that it would one day have an ending.
So all of the books, the animated series, the TV series, and the films all folded into one box and then boxed away.
Not boxed away. People can still enjoy them. Oh, yeah, they still exist, you know, but like I just...
But boxed off.
Yeah.
Boxed off.
Yeah, I guess. Like just like make room for a different universe of space tales.
Would you have like a Melancholia style ending where...
No.
All the characters are on Tatooine and then Coruscant smashes into it.
No.
No?
No, it wouldn't be a miserable ending. It wouldn't be like the end of the physical end of the physical Star Wars universe. It would just be, we're done now. You know, Tony, you can rest now, you know? It'd be like that.
Helen, why?
That's what I want.
Why would you do such a thing? Kobe, how would you end it? Would you end it with, I don't know, Rey changing her name by Deadpool? Would you do that?
What I actually want is the actual process of her going to... It would be Coruscant, wouldn't it? She'd have to go through the administrative period, you know, offices, going to the wrong office, going to the wrong floor.
Yep.
All through that tedium of actually having to, like, change her name.
The Star Wars equivalent, or was it the DVLA?
Yeah.
That's what you have to do over here? Yeah? Or, you know, when you get your passport, your I visa renewed, you have to do all that?
All that shit. That would be the great way. That would be the best way to finish it. No, it wouldn't.
No, it really wouldn't. Although that said, some of my favourite moments in Andor were the crushing weight of imperial bureaucracy. Mm. So perhaps it could be fun. What would it cost to get your name changed? 1/2 portion. I don't know.
I like the way you set yourself up there for that one.
Thank you. I think that obviously the final Star Wars movie, The Last Jedi, was a perfectly fine place to end the series.
It had the word last in the title, right?
Yeah, do you know what I mean? It's done.
Like Avengers Endgame. Everyone knows that's when the MCU
Marvel
was meant
movie.
To finish.
Absolutely,
yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
But I was literally having this conversation over lunch about how I'm very excited for things like The Acolyte, you know, and I'm totally psyched for more Mandalorian and Grogu stuff. But
yes,
equally.
Oh my God, Mandalorian sits on Grogu, the end.
No.
Yes.
Wow.
Crushes him. The last thing you hear is a little spine popping.
No.
Yes.
You're a monster.
No. What?
No. Much as I hate to say this with my Pilot TV hat on, they should stop all Star Wars TV shows.
Clip that.
Stop them.
Put that out.
Can we see what The Acolyte's like first?
We can, because I really want to see that.
I really want to see that.
And the only reason I say that is not because I don't like the Star Wars TV shows, although some of them. Also, Andor Series 2 is one of the things I'm most excited about. Mm-hmm. So don't, like, put out Andor Series 2, obviously, first. But then wait, like, stop everything, and then wait. And then, like, the Rey movies, which are coming, interested to see those. But I need them to be events in the way The Rise of Skywalker, for all of its many, 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 many flaws, was an event, like a big event. Like that year, which brought us, lest we forget, the finale of Game of Thrones, Avengers Endgame, and The Rise of Skywalker. Like these were events. They were pop cultural events. And I feel that Star Wars, and to a certain extent Marvel, has stopped being cultural events because there's so much of it.
Well, that's
different mediums.
That's one of the reasons I'm really excited for Deadpool and Wolverine this year. It's the one Marvel film we're going to get.
Except it's not. Because it is for us nerdy people who know that it's the only MCU film. But for the average person, it's just one gem in a big pool of spunk.
Yeah.
And do you know what I mean? They don't see the distinction between them. So for us, sure. For everyone else, no.
I will say, I do think they should finish the Star Wars universe with films, with three films.
Yes,
they should.
It should come to an end on the big screen, not the small. I think that's really important.
With one cohesive narrative.
Yes.
all the way through it.
That makes sense, that is planned beforehand.
With
that
makes sense. Creative voice overseeing it, whether it's the same director in all three films or...
Kevin Feige type bod.
Yeah, or like a George Lucas type bod.
Yeah, they could give that a go, having some kind of cohesive narrative across a trilogy. That'd be a nice novelty. But
James, how did George Lucas plan to end his episode 7, 8, and 9? Do you know?
I know that the concept that he sold to Disney when he sold them Lucasfilm was very midichlorian heavy. He's talked about this with James Cameron when he did that sort of sci-fi symposium. And it was like, it was really getting into the midichlorians now. And like, it was like, in the nicest way, George, nobody wants that. Nobody needs it. So I do agree with them for stepping away from that. But I equally, and I've said this many times, they should have had a coherent vision across three films and not just said, hey, do a film. And then the next guy's problem is to, you know, it's like that thing, that exercise you used to do in English class where you'd write a sentence and then the next person would pick it up. And
now called Taliban.
Exactly, a completely different sentence. Yeah. It's like, no, we need this to be joined up in some fashion. But look, and I'm not going to hold Star Wars completely responsible for the state the cinema is in at the moment, but I do think when you take away the sort of sparkly eventness of a lot of these things, it makes cinema feel less essential, and that's a really bad thing. It's a bad thing when people don't feel they need to go to the cinema, because ultimately, if you want sort of mid-level, sort of mid-tempo drama, you are fucking covered on streaming. But we went to the cinema for large spectacle event cinema, but then when that event stuff, when the Star Wars, when the Marvel, when all that stuff is also on streaming, you know, and sure, we've got, you know, your Top Gun Mavericks, we've got Mission Impossible, we've got Furiosa. There is good stuff in the cinema, let's not pretend there isn't. But I feel like they are almost on a mission to make cinema less special. And that seems incredibly short-sighted to me, and it makes me sad.
Yeah, that's part of a bigger discussion about the devaluation of cinema, I think. But it is not helpful, you're right. I think there's a place for things like Andor that do something very different that wouldn't work in cinema,
100%.
But within the universe of Star Wars. I think the mistake is trying to make the shows too cinematic in a weird way.
Yeah.
We need to finish on the medal ceremony. That's why. Everyone gets the medal.
Except Chewie.
No, everyone gets the medal.
No, it's a medal ceremony just for Chewie.
Just for Chewie.
I would be so there for that.
I know you would.
It would end with a Chewbacca solo movie. I would be absolutely... first, and let's be honest, last in line. No, it'd be me and Phil Chupitus. We'd be, the two of us would be first and last in line for that one. Listen, there's a very good argument being made that it already has the perfect ending, and it's the ending of Return of the Jedi, and how can you possibly top that? Yeah, but we shall see. We shall see. Someone else will be tasked with this many, many years after we have died.
Yeah.
When Coruscant smashes into the earth.
But like, seriously though, we do need new room for new cultural things.
We do, but not right now.
Yes.
Let's move on real quick. A couple of people have asked, writing Freak 88, would you rather cuddle Grogu or an Ewok? Is this pre-flattened or post-flattened? It's very important.
You're
after Mando has sat on Grogu, I would rather cuddle Grogu before that, when it's not just gristle.
I'm going to say neither one. It's obviously Chewy. Don't be ridiculous.
You want to cuddle Chewy?
You cuddle Chewy. I have cuddled Chewy.
You would definitely hug Chewy.
Yeah, Chewy is very cuddleable. Though I will say, no disrespect to Chewy, he has hygiene issues. Like, I know he's, you know, kind of made of yak hair, but he has a wet dog musk going on.
I think it depends on what you want to do with a cuddle. I think for me, if I'm going to hang out...
Hang on.
No one's saying you have to spoon with him.
All right.
I just mean, if you want to like hang out on the sofa and cuddle, Chewie's not your guy for that. I'm going to be...
So you're on the bed.
Yeah.
Chewie's on the bed.
Oh, no.
Not
Mike
the bed.
Feist is on the bed.
What?
Hello.
Hold on.
I think Wookie Nookie was probably beyond the scope of this.
Wookie Nookie.
Nope.
Star Wars episode 77.
69.
Well, execute order 69.
Oh boy.
Wookie Nookie.
And that's how Star Wars finishes. Thank you very much, Patrick Cottonwile.
Oh,
that's
boom.
That's the end of it.
That's not boo milk.
Spunk.
That's no
the
moon.
The problem, like, this would definitely have to be like a very consensual hug. Like, I think that's really important to say.
Of course it would be consensual.
Okay, well, I'm making it clear because like the Ewoks will fuck your shit up. I'm just saying.
Grogu will fuck your shit up.
Exactly. Mm. If you'd let me finish the sentence.
Oh, okay.
The Ewoks will fight your shit up. We know this because they took on an army and won. And also they eat people. And then on the other hand, Grogu, not super cuddly all the time. Like super cute. Yes.
Also filled with wires and machinery.
He likes frog or two, doesn't he?
Chewie eats porgs.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, who among us would not eat a porg? They look delicious.
I would 100% eat a porg. Lemon and herb in a pitta.
No, not lemon and herb. No, medium. Medium, and then I have hot sauce on the side just so I can spice it up for the odd mouthful or two.
Wow, way to put anybody off eating porgs by comparing it to fucking Nando's.
Whoa. That's the worst thing you've said in this podcast, and there's some pretty fucking stiff competition. All right, very, very quick. Someone else has asked, I've lost your name, will they ever reboot Star Wars? Will they ever remake the original?
Well, Zack Snyder's trying to at the moment with mixed success, so...
I don't know who said that.
I mean, everything seems to get rebooted ultimately.
Surely it has to stop for them to reboot it.
That's, I guess, our one protection.
Yeah, it's never going to end, so they'll never get a chance.
No, but it might end for a short time. And then, I mean, it did end for a short time back in the day before everything became rebooted. So it is possible. Because you do get kids now going like, what the fuck is this pacing? What are all these wipes? How slow is this film? Like, they don't get it. So it's not impossible.
They should be made to get it.
Clockwork Orange-wise, eyes open, eyes akimbo.
Yeah, just put them in the Clockwork Orange machine and just tell them, this is what cinema looks like. Just get with it.
On a more serious point, like Russell T. Davies has essentially now rebooted Doctor Who. So obviously he rebooted it in 2005 and we got Doctor Who brackets 2005. This new series of Doctor Who, which starts this week, is essentially Doctor Who brackets 2024. And he's saying this is essentially season one of Doctor Who. So he is consciously saying, I'm starting again.
Consciously.
and so I'm wondering, you know, could they not do that? Could Kathy Kennedy say, do you know what? Star Wars, episode one, do it. And it's just a whole
thing. No, if you're remaking the prequels.
The taxation of trade routes.
I'm on board. None of that. You start with Anakin growing up. Mm-hmm. You have a sort of epic love story over three films rather than a freaking annoying small child.
Hey, are you dissing George Lucas? He made perfect creative decisions on the trilogy, one of the trilogies. Anyway, okay, that's enough, I think, because we have to move on. If you want to have your question read out in the Empire podcast, non-Star Wars questions, please, next week. Sorry if we didn't get around to your Star Wars question. I'm on Twitter. Is that Chris Hewitt? You can slide into my DMs, you can reply to a panicked shout-out every now and again, or you can reply to any of my tweets once you've stopped laughing, of course, including you can even see the initial workshop version of Balmy by Your Game. That's right, folks. Why would you ever leave Twitter when gold is there at your fingertips, Helen? At your fingertips.
Yeah.
Should we have a guest?
Please.
Who do you want? Do you want Rose Glass?
Yes. Or
Rose Glass, of course, a wonderful British director, burst onto the scene a couple of years ago, pre-pandemic, with Saint Maud, terrifying Saint Maud, a movie that really gets under your skin and then sets it on fire. And now she's back this week with Love Lies Bleeding, starring Kristen Stewart and Katie M. O'Brien out of...
Susan Mandalorian.
Everything comes back to Star Wars, folks.
Yeah.
And Ed Harris, who's never been in Star Wars and I'm sure has never seen one. I just don't imagine Ed Harris watching a Star Wars somehow. Doesn't strike me as his cup of tea.
I think he's somebody's beloved grandfather and has probably sat down with such a person and watched it.
Do you think?
Yeah.
And then judged it.
Yeah.
And then thrown a brick at the TV.
Possible.
Yeah, I think so. But this one is a departure from Saint Maud. This is more of a queer romance between Kristen Stewart and Katie Emma Bryan's characters, set against the backdrop of this noirish thriller. To say any more would be to spoil the movie, which we almost do in this interview. I was actually in the room in the studio when Rose Glass came into the studio. The first time we've had a guest in our new studios, folks. And she sat down and she talked about the movie with Sophie Butcher. But don't worry, this is spoiler-free, but very, very fun indeed. Here's Rose Glass talking about Love Lies Bleeding. Enjoy.
Rose Glass, director of Love Lies Bleeding. Welcome to the Empire podcast. Oh, so delighted to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me.
And in person in our studio, which we're very happy about.
Quite exciting.
Yes, definitely. I'm very excited that this movie is coming out. It's taken a while. It's already been out in the US. How has the reaction been to it so far?
So far, so good, to be honest. I'm kind of, I just got back from America. It got released there, I can't remember how long ago now. A few weeks ago. So it's all been a little bit of a whirlwind, but generally seems to be going down well and people are enjoying it. So that's a big relief.
Mm. Has there been anything that people have picked up on that's kind of surprised you or that you didn't think that they would fixate on from the film?
Oh, I mean, just I mean, I shouldn't have been surprised, but I guess just the level of kind of fangirling over Lou and Jackie as a couple has just been very lovely to see. And I guess, to be honest, also just the general kind of like look of the characters. I think obviously because I've been so close to it for so long, the novelty of Ed's hair and the costumes and stuff sort of wears off pretty quickly. So it's been great to see people reacting for the first time. Like, oh my God, they look mad.
It looks so cool, which it does. It looks so cool. Just to give a bit of an insight into how this came about, this is, you know, it's a queer romance. It's a revenge thriller. It's about bodybuilders and arms dealers and all sorts. There's a lot going on in the best kind of way. Where did the idea first come from for you, and what was your kind of way into the story?
It was basically like a sort of kernel of an idea that I had when I was in post-production for St. Maud's, and for a long time was just this vague idea floating in my head that it would be cool to do a story about a female bodybuilder. And I think maybe because, I don't know, getting your first film off the ground is quite a sort of stressful, long, uncertain sort of process. So I think second time around, it just felt like, you know, I was excited to get to do another film, and I just wanted to, I don't know, just do something that was a lot of fun and sort of take some risks and try something a bit different from Maud. So I don't know, doing something which was like kind of violent and pulpy and kind of funny just seemed appealing. And then I decided to team up with my co-writer, Veronica Tvilska, took this really basic idea to her, and then the two of us just kind of spent ages sort of fleshing it out and trying to entertain and surprise each other.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And for fans of St. Maud, which was such a great kind of debut, how would you describe the sort of through line between that film and this one? I know it's very different in tone and style, but what would you say it kind of has in common?
I'd say a fair bit, to be honest. I mean, it sort of morphed far more into its own thing, but certainly that initial kernel was, I think there's a fair bit of crossover between the characters of Maud and maybe both Lou and Jackie in this film. But, you know, I guess on some level they're both about people, you know, women who feel in some aspect powerless or insignificant in their life, kind of trying to transform themselves in this slightly grandiose, potentially ill-advised kind of way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're both kind of outsiders. They're sort of, there's a kind of obsession with physicality and perfection and all that sort of stuff that is really ripe kind of ground.
Yeah. It's people kind of going to sort of obsessive lengths to sort of feel kind of powerful and strong and maybe sort of getting into trouble along the way.
Yeah, absolutely. I spoke to you and the cast for our magazine feature a little while ago. And when I talked to Kristen Stewart, she told me that the idea was partly inspired by the fact you were in a position where you'd had this great success with St. Maud. You were figuring out what to do next. You'd had a kernel of an idea, and you'd been kind of encouraged by the industry to work on something maybe about a sort of air quotes strong woman. Eye roll, I know. And that Love Lies Bleeding was kind of you sort of pushing back against that, but also kind of taking it and running with it. I mean, can you talk a little bit about that? How much of that is true, and how much that kind of tongue-in-cheek response of what's expected from a female filmmaker sort of informed the movie by the end?
I think that it was kind of a bit of a joke, really, sort of. I think I wanted to do the thing about a bodybuilder anyway, and then it was kind of like, oh, look, it's a strong female character kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And it was more like, I think when I was promoting Maud, you know, I'd be getting, and it's been nice because there's already a bit less of those kind of questions this time around, but inevitably there are a lot of questions about, like, as a woman, as a female filmmaker, how did you find X? As a female filmmaker, how did you find the violence? And, you know, your film has a very strong, complex female character, blah, blah, blah. Which, you know, I'm kind of, you know, I don't want to be ungrateful, like, you know, the film got a great response and stuff. But it was, I think maybe just hearing that kind of phrase quite repeatedly in different contexts, I was just a bit like, well, that's a bit of a hollow sort of concept. You would never say like a strong male character, because it's just a bit of a, I don't know, it's a bit, you know, I think already it sounds a bit of a passé kind of thing, which I think is good. But particularly when I was first kind of telling people about the idea, that would just be like a bit of a joke we'd crack. I think when me and Veronica were writing it as well, it was, I think also we were maybe sort of slightly aware of a feeling of there being a sort of desire for female characters now, particularly to sort of have an element of kind of moral righteousness to them as well, which I think is something we both enjoyed kind of gleefully pushing against, and enjoyed having men and women both doing awful, mixed up kind of things, but hopefully enjoying and understanding why they're doing it along the way.
Yeah, absolutely. It's so satisfying to see. I mean, seeing Kristen promote this film, and the whole team, but kind of Kristen in particular for me, I'm a big fan of her. It's been a real joy, like her Rolling Stone cover, all the photo shoots and stuff. Great. How open she's been about wanting to embrace a kind of different side of herself that Love Lies Bleeding really shows off. Can you talk about what in Kristen you saw that made you so keen to get her on board, but also how it's been from that first meeting with her to now, sort of seeing how that different side of her has come out and the sort of reaction to it as well?
I mean, to me, she just seemed like a really kind of natural fit for the character. And I think, you know, I think I always, I mean, you know, she's incredible. She's a fantastic actress. And I think it's, she's just, I don't know, she's just kind of really cool and funny. And, you know, it's a steamy love story. I thought it would be really great and hot to have her against a character like Jackie. And it would just be a lot of fun, I thought. And I think actually, like, her doing sort of dark comedy as well is something which I feel she's particularly good at. And, you know, it would be great to see her do more of that kind of thing. It's weird. I sort of felt that she was such a natural fit for it, but also when I thought about it, I couldn't actually remember her having played that many characters like this, which is strange because when you sort of get to know her, it's sort of like there's a fair amount of crossover, I'd say.
Yeah, and you're right. Once you see her in it, it's so right, but it's kind of, why hasn't she done anything like this before?
I think we both enjoyed like the fact that, like, I think, you know, the character she plays in this looks in some ways a bit like a sort of overgrown, petulant kind of teenager, sort of on one hand, but then also this sort of moody anti-hero sort of film noir heartthrobby sort of thing, sort of all mixed up with some weird sort of neuroses. But then she kept sort of describing me as being like petulant or bratty for sort of for talking about the strong female character stuff. So I think basically there was a sort of slightly, I don't know, irreverent, angsty, teenagery kind of thing that I think both of us enjoyed with this character.
Yeah, like a kindred spirit that she saw exactly. In that attitude. That's so cool. There's obviously a lot of bodybuilding, a lot of gym stuff in this film. Was there a lot of that on set? Like, would Katie and Kristen be kind of dropping and doing push-ups?
They did, actually, yeah. I think, again, this is like maybe Kristen being sort of competitive, whatever, but yeah, Katie, who plays Jackie, was obviously, you know, obviously in scenes, she's doing a fair amount of working out. And then before she has to do those sorts of scenes, she's like kind of like pumping up and stuff. So she looks amazing on camera. Mm-hmm. And I think when she did that, inevitably Kristen would be kind of like, I can do it as well. And then she'd start doing push-ups and pull-ups. Although I kept being like, no, don't do it. I need you to look pathetic and scrawny. But she could do a surprising amount of pull-ups, which I can do zero of. So yeah, they both made me feel incredibly feeble.
I was going to say, has it inspired you to start pumping?
I thought it would. Like, when I was writing this, I was like, you know what? I'm going to get in amazing shape when I'm writing this. By the time I do the press, I'm going to be like, they're going to be like, ooh. And it did not happen. I think I'm far more in line with Kristen's character, who's like just pathetically sort of trying and failing to give up smoking throughout the film, which I have now managed. But definitely when I was writing it, I was much more in that kind of camp of just like, why is it that, like, let alone actually training to, you know, the sort of discipline it requires to be a bodybuilder is like one thing. And why is it some people are able to do that and the rest of us, it's like it's just impossible to even just voluntarily stop doing the thing, which is definitely slowly killing you.
I really empathise with that.
Don't smoke, guys.
No. Go to the gym. Yeah, it's good for you. You've said before that you thought of Jackie as a little like a superhero, which I think is so interesting and so cool. Can you talk a bit about what that means to you and how that kind of came through in the final film?
Well, she kind of, in terms of the role she plays, I guess, in Lou's life, you know, who's kind of like stuck in a rut and sort of never left this crappy town that she grew up in. All she does is complain about it and never actually does anything. And then Jackie kind of appears as, I don't know, this stranger who just kind of like comes into town and completely blows Lou's world apart and kind of does all the things and embodies all the things which Lou kind of is incapable of doing herself and sort of... so in that sense, there's a kind of superhero equality of in some twisted sort of way in like the role that she plays in Lou's life, I think. And obviously there's some more literal stuff towards the end which happens. But I don't know, it's sort of, but I guess hopefully throughout the film you kind of realise in some level she's sort of put up on a pedestal in this sort of overly simplified, she's so strong and powerful kind of way. But actually sort of, you know, strength in and of itself and, you know, all these kind of things only go so far. And actually Jackie's character, the more she ends up being embroiled in Lou's life and getting Lou out of her shell, the more detrimental the consequences are on her, and actually her life ends up getting kind of more messed up as a result of her entanglement with Lou.
Yeah.
But boy, it feels good along the way.
Yeah, and it kind of subverts that thing where it seems like she's the most powerful one, but actually Lou's the one controlling a lot of stuff.
Kind of, yeah. I think that used to be much more explicit when me and Veronica were first writing it, this idea of sort of Lou kind of like feeding off Jackie a bit or kind of manipulating her, and the idea of, you know, toxic codependent sort of relationships, which I think is still there. But weirdly, I think once we cast those two, actually, they're just so good together, which I think it almost kind of distracts you from the reality of what the characters are doing throughout the film. And actually, I think they're just incredibly sort of sweet and lovely together as a couple. So, but hopefully that's a fun thing. You're kind of like, oh, I want them to be together, but oh, it doesn't seem like a good idea.
No, yes, yeah, I was gonna, that was one of my questions, how you keep rooting for them and they're such good anti-heroes, and I think that's exactly why. Saint Maud had a lot of wince-inducing moments, I'm going to say, yes. But also held a lot back, I think, in a really great way. With Love Lies Bleeding, though, the violence
less
feels
so.
a lot more explicit and visceral, but brilliantly so. Like, it's so delicious to see. What made you decide to kind of go really hard with that side of things and amp that up in this one?
I think it was just felt like the right thing to do. Maybe because I think Maud was a much more, you know, it's also a much smaller budget. You know, it's a lot more, it sort of had to be a lot more controlled and restrained in some ways. And the character's obviously very kind of repressed. And so, you know, it just sort of fit that story. But then I kind of suspect that the combination of making that film and then having it sort of swallowed up by the pandemic, you know, even though the film went down well, there was maybe a sort of feeling of some kind of energy or feeling which never quite got released after that film. So I sort of suspect in hindsight it sort of instead got channeled into writing this thing with Veronica during lockdown when, you know, we can't go outside. And so, you know, you sort of, it became a bit more of like an outlet, the writing of it. And it was just stuff that I was, you know, I've always liked really violent films. So that was just what I had an urge to do.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned Veronica then, you co-wrote this with her. You say after a kind of an intense experience with St. Maud, you wanted to work with someone on writing.
Yeah.
What's your kind of thinking on that going forward? Is that something that you really enjoyed? Do you want to take that collaboration, you know, forward with you? Or are you thinking, I'd like to zero in on something just myself next time?
I think the next one, I'm writing something by myself at the moment, but I'm already really missing Veronica and I keep being like, oh, I want to do it again. But she, you know, she's a writer-director as well. You know, we both had our own stuff in development. She, in fact, just directed Baby Reindeer that's out now, which is...
She did. I spotted her name and I was like, wait, I know that name. And I was like,
She's having a mad time at the moment. Suddenly, like all these, you know, it's all been so... It all happens so sort of secretly and privately when you're doing it. And then suddenly she's having both these things come at the same time.
Yeah.
So, you know, she's off doing her own thing now. But I'd love to team up with her again in the future.
Uh-huh. Yeah, absolutely. I wanted to ask, like, taking you back to actually shooting the film, can you remember, like, a favourite day or a most surreal moment on set where it felt like you were really sort of capturing some magic? And, like, you were, obviously, you shot this in Albuquerque. It was a kind of wild location. Yeah. Is there a day that really stands out from the shoot for you?
Oh, I always freeze up when I sort of, because suddenly you're like, remember every day from the shoot.
Yeah.
It's like, what was the best ones? There are a lot of quite stressful days. I mean, I think definitely shooting the Giants stuff. I mean, spoiler, but I'm kind of like, I think it's fine if people know about Giants even when they go in. But definitely shooting that was one of the most surreal days. And it was the first time I'd had to shoot stuff where it's kind of, you know, green screen. So, you shoot the kind of like plate shot. So there's a bit where... Could I be saying all this spoiler stuff? Whatever.
You don't have to go right into it, but there's some scale stuff happening. And yes. I guess you have to shoot the small scale in the location.
Yeah.
But then big scale on a green screen? Is that how you kind of...
I mean, basically, to be honest, any day with Ed where we were having to get him to do something ridiculous was surreal because it's someone that you've just sort of like grown up seeing in film.
Yeah.
So then when it's kind of... And I'm sure he was looking around. Okay, he was a lovely guy to work with, by the way, but I'm sure there were days he was probably looking around being like, what the fuck is this movie? but he was very up for anything. So some of the directions I had to give him were quite hilarious.
Mm-hmm.
What else was good? Oh, no, actually, probably the most fun day was like the bodybuilding competition.
Right, yeah.
When Jackie sort of gets to Vegas, you know, she's kind of hitchhiking through the town that Lou lives in to get to Vegas. By the time she gets there, things don't go as you'd expect. But we basically had to shoot this whole bodybuilding competition with professional bodybuilders and Katie sort of like really holding her own in there as well with this amazing audience of... background artists, and we had like five cameras going and like lots of music pumping, and we basically had to like film a whole competition with all these different categories of like guys and women doing lineups and poses, and that was that was just incredibly fun, like in between like having to like oil them all up and stuff and then kind of call out the poses. Oh yeah, and I was there like on the microphone sort of pretending to be the kind of like MC, just kind of calling people through the timings.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, that was one of those very sort of, oh, this is my job. Yeah. This is great.
Just, what am I doing right now?
Yeah, exactly. Really fun.
Yeah. From seeing the response to the film, I mean, it already feels very ripe to achieve a kind of cult queer movie status to me, something like Bound or But I'm a Cheerleader or anything like that. I mean, do you agree? And I mean, how does that feel? Is that something you ever expected or hoped for, or is that just kind of a wonderful thing to...
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I find it weird, the idea of saying that anything that's only just coming out can be in any way culty.
Yeah.
I guess in the sense, maybe it has a sense, shared sensibility with some of those films, and that, you know, probably I was thinking about a lot of kind of campy sort of classics when making it. So maybe it's got that kind of feel, but it's strange. Maybe that's just a... I'm like, surely something can't qualify as any sort of cult anything until it's at least 10 years old or something like that. But it's great if anyone says that.
We'll talk to him in 10 years.
Enjoy it. Yeah, exactly.
And see. Yeah. Rose Glass, thank you so much for talking to us. I love the film. I can't wait for everyone to see it. And
thanks so
much.
Great to talk to you. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Okay, that was Rose Glass. We'll be talking about Love Lies Bleeding later on in the show, in the reviews section. Oh my God, I'm watching TV on right here. There's a kid with a broom. I'm getting flashbacks to Star Wars Episode 8, The Final One. That's what they called it. Anyway, movie news time. What has been happening in the world of movie news, folks?
We like to talk about trailers here, but I'm going to raise you a screen grab.
And you're going to raise me a screen grab?
Raise you a screen grab. All right. A screen grab from Francis Ford Coppola's new film, Megalopolis, which he released on his Instagram account and also the film's Instagram account, which shows Adam Driver and Natalie Emmanuel. And this is his first film for over a decade. So I'm keen to see what this is. And I'm not a Francis Ford Coppola completionist in any way, shape or form, but it's got me excited.
I mean, it's a cool image. I hope it's a cool film. But it mostly is a man looking through a telescope and a woman looking slightly concerned at him.
It's a good telescope.
But what a man, Helen. What a man.
I like him.
Kylo Ren.
Hey, do you feel like Josh O'Connor is going to challenge Adam Driver for all those slightly weird dude roles? Anyway, just a thought.
I don't know. I have to say, kudos to Francis Ford Coppola and kudos to Michael Mann recently, who did something that I didn't think would be possible, and they got Adam Driver to cut his hair. I thought that he would be very much like, nope, my hair is staying. It took me ages to grow this out, but he's cut it for Megalopolis. It's a opening image.
Yeah,
it looks very CG heavy. I'm not sure it looks very good CG heavy, sadly, and I have a feeling that this may be one of the things that is to the film's detriment once it's seen. That I just don't know whether the effects are going to be good or not. But hopefully. We're always rooting for a legend of cinema.
It's coming out in Cannes. It's been shown in Cannes in the next couple of weeks, isn't it? So we'll get a response quite soon, I think.
Yeah. We will. We'll know exactly what the world thinks of it, and also what the world thinks of Furiosa. If you're talking about George Miller and Kevin Costner's return to the directing chair with Horizon Chapter 1, the first of four chapters. It's a hell of a time at the moment. But I'm excited. I'm sure we'll see a trailer as well.
Yeah.
But we did see a trailer, as James said, for Mufasa. The Lion King. Barry Jenkins. I love this. Every time I say this sentence, it makes me laugh. Barry Jenkins prequel to the Jon Favreau original. I want this to happen now. I want Barry Jenkins to do nothing but make prequels to Jon Favreau movies. I want to see him make Young Chef. I want to see that.
Iron Man.
You just
0.5.
Want to see Young Iron Man. Mm. Come on, you're not thinking about Chef when you say that.
I am thinking about Chef. Chef is the best Jon Favreau movie. Directed. Best Jon Favreau directed movie.
Whoa.
That's not controversial.
I love Chef, but I'm just surprised
controversial.
You said that.
You know my thoughts on the first two Iron Man movies. I think they're perfectly solid building blocks in the MCU.
I'm telling Tony on you, that's all I'm saying.
You can tell Tony on me because he pulled it back with the best Iron Man movie, Iron Man 3.
Mm. True.
Yeah, but otherwise, I think that Iron Man is a four-star film. I think that Iron Man 2 is also a film. And and if you look at the rest of his directorial career, the likes of Maid and The Jungle Book and The Lion King, and he's a good Sathura.
Who can forget Sathura?
Jinx.
Elf?
Elf.
There we go. I thought that was one that's missing in my
the
mind.
The beloved yeah. Elf. But Chef's his best movie. Chef's his best movie. Come on, Colby.
I love Chef. I love Chef.
You're agreeing with me.
I love Chef, but...
Elf, I don't know.
I think I'll do Elf. That sounds terrible.
Wow. Christmas around your house must be a real
problem. He really is a buddy.
Elf and Chewie at the same time? Or, you know, I don't
really... So hang on.
This is not challenges. Why are you trying to bring him back to
challenges?
You're
sitting on the bed, and then Chewie is on the bed next to you, and then Buddy the Elf.
I did wonder why you smelled like beef and cheese.
That's not a throne of lies you're sitting on.
Oh, boy. Anyway, Mufasa.
Yeah.
I'll be honest, I haven't seen it. So please tell me about it.
I mean,
why is that ice?
It's so many of my favorite things in a movie.
You love lions.
I love Barry Jenkins. Do I love lions? I don't know. I don't love The Lion King. Mm-hmm. I didn't love the quote unquote.
Hold on. Which version of Lion King? The original.
I didn't love the original.
She doesn't like the original either.
God, you have no joy in your life.
And the remake. I was offended by any mention of it being live action because there was literally one frame of footage I think that's live action in the entire thing. So that offended me. But also, it didn't add anything; it just made it longer. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, as you know, I also have strong feelings about musicals that pretend not to be musicals, which this is and which it does. And
this is a musical, right? This one?
It is. No, and you know that because at the end of the trailer, there's a single shot that says, you know, with new songs written by Lin-Manuel Miranda, mm-hmm. who I also like. So, like, I am trying to keep an open mind for this, but, like, it is a prequel, so inherently doesn't need to exist, to a film that I fundamentally don't care about. And so I am struggling. I'm struggling a little bit with it. And also, lions don't tend to live in the snow, as far as I know, so...
This is the thing that's confusing. I'm like... Lenny okay. Manny, Barry Jenkins.
Lenny Manny, love a bit Lenny Manny. Lion Manuel Miranda, you will.
No, go. I won't.
You should.
just the involvement of those two people alone makes me think there's something to it. I agree with you, Helen, in terms of the live action quote unquote version, which just left me cold, and I'll always go to the original hand drawn animated version. But this one, it just look. Hopefully there's something to be pulled from it when it comes to the screens, but I don't understand why there's ice. I don't understand why there's snow. That's really confusing me. It's pulling me off kilter when I watch the trailer.
I beg your pardon? We're back to Chewie and Buddy in the
hotel
room.
What is going on here?
Everything you're doing, Buddy. You're being pulled off by Mufasa. This is just obscene.
It's a circle of life.
But why is there ice? Why is there ice? Why is there snow? What's going on here, guys?
They're meant to be up on like Kilimanjaro or something, I think.
Right.
Like that's the theory.
So this is Mufasa.
Judging by the interview he gave us.
This is pre-flattened Mufasa.
So Mufasa's getting flattened.
Well, he gets flattened.
I suppose he does, yeah.
He gets totally IKEA'd.
By wildebeest.
Flat pack.
Yeah.
Death by wildebeest, indeed. He gets stampeded, spoilers for The Lion King. but he does. And so this is a prequel. So this is the tale of... But it's also a Godfather Part 2 type thing, isn't it? Where there's... You also see Simba.
As a dual timelines?
I think so.
Okay.
Well, yeah, because have Donald Glover and Beyonce, you see, back. So there's obviously some kind of framing device. Maybe like Simba's mum talking him through, your father wasn't always a king. He became a king. And here's the story of how I don't care.
So, right there is a problem. So I don't want to be like Lion King lore guy, but am I imagining this? Or is there a point where Mufasa says to Simba,
this is CNN.
We come from a long line of kings, you know, and it's been passed down.
Maybe it's like a metaphor and they weren't like literally kings, but they were like metaphorically kings.
It's the parallelogram of life.
Well, perhaps it is. But in this, he literally says a king who had no royal blood. And I was like, I call bullshit.
Yeah.
That's
lying king. More like
lying king.
And why are Timon and Pumbaa involved? Maybe they're in the framing device, if it is a framing device, which we don't know.
It must be a framing device, but also...
Because money, they can sell the toys.
Yeah,
that's right.
Really true.
That's right, James, you're absolutely right. Hey guys, if you have any problems with this film, Hakuna Matata.
That's a very good philosophy.
For life in general.
Which wasn't a direct quote, I realise, but I don't care enough about The Lion King to get the quote right.
Hey Helen,
I don't
You know
this.
What?
I could have
Hakuna
said,
Matata.
What a wonderful phrase. There we go. There
it means no worries.
Ain't no passing craze.
Oh, Jesus.
Ain't no worries. We don't have a PRS license. Shut up.
Okay, shut up. That was fair use. That was fair use.
If this gives Barry Jenkins the money to make another Beale Street, if Beale Street could talk, then I hope 10 out of 10, no notes.
I know I've seen people say this on Twitter, but you know what? I hope he makes nothing but movies like this for the rest of his career and just gets film Twitter increasingly angry with him.
If he makes them well, if this has the emotional whammy of a Moonlight, then great, again.
Yeah.
Like, I am here to be corrected. I am here to be taught the error of my ways on the whole Lion King universe and to have the scales fall from my eyes, which is weird because lions don't have scales. And
They do now.
And suddenly be like, oh my God, I get it now. It's the most wonderful Disney film. But it isn't, and I don't love it at the moment, and I'm not excited. It's up there, isn't it?
It is up there, very much so. It might be my favourite Disney musical.
It's not even my top 10.
I love it so much.
It's fine.
Little Mermaid, Aladdin, Lion King, they can interchange depending on what mood I'm in.
Little Mermaid and Aladdin, and then Moana. Moana, yep, absolutely.
Jungle Book.
I do like Moana.
Meet the Robinsons. No, I'm kidding. Jungle Book for me.
Meet the Robinsons is cute, but no, it's not top 10.
All right.
You've all forgotten Sleeping Beauty, but you know, whatever.
Haven't forgotten it.
Nope.
No, Sleeping Beauty's great.
Sleeping Beauty is great.
Sleeping Beauty's great.
Slept through it.
Oh, very good. Very good.
Yeah, but you sleep through this podcast, and this podcast is great. So
I'm not surprised Kobe slept through it after his exertions with Buddy the Elf and Chewbacca.
There was also news that Paul Walter Hauser has joined the new Naked Gun opposite Liam Neeson.
Big Liam and Pamela Anderson, of course. This is the Naked Gun remake, and he's going to be playing Captain Ed Hocken, who was the role played in Naked Gun by George Kennedy and in Police Squad by Alan North. And the fact that they've announced his character means that I guess that they're not going down the remake road. They're not going down the sequel road because there were some rumors that Liam Neeson was going to be playing the son of Frank Drebin in this, but clearly not. This must be a remake.
They've left off a junior on Captain Ed Hocken.
Quite possibly, yeah.
So, but yeah, I mean, look, he's funny, so I'm hopeful for this.
Yeah, I am also hopeful for this. The people involved are good people; they know they're funny. Akiva Schaffer of The Lonely Island is directing it, so I'm hopeful. The Naked Gun is obviously one of the funniest films of all time. It is beloved to me, but it's not to say that you can't take it and put your own stamp on it, right? Like Mufasa, the Lion King.
I mean, I hope it's great. I hope it's great. I'm worried about just its very existence, but Akiva Schaffer is a fantastic director and he's funny. Is he funny in the same way as the Zaz guys? I don't know.
I mean, pop star never stopping, never say stopping. That one, you know that one. That's amazing. He directed Hot Rod, one of the greatest movies of all time. So yes,
Chippendale, Rescue Ranger.
Yes, indeed, he directed that as well.
I mean, these are all funny and great films, but are they Airplane style?
Gagfest.
Yeah.
I mean, actually, pretty funny. Yeah, there's the hit rate in Chippendale and in Hot Rod and in Popstar is pretty freaking high.
It's pretty high. It's maybe not. It's higher than Airplane 2. Higher than Airplane 2, but not higher than Airplane 1.
Nothing's higher than Airplane 1.
I smiled once.
Oh, boy.
This is James' therapy session.
I know now why you smile.
Something I could never do.
I smiled once. It was about December 1986.
It's true. We should take this opportunity to address a grave injustice.
A grave injustice? Mm.
In that on last week's podcast, when we talked about all manner of frankly pointless trailers, we did not mention the big trailer of last week, which was, of course, M. Night Shyamalan's Trap.
That was the twist.
The twist was we didn't cover it. So this is Josh Hartnett as a father taking his daughter to, frankly, a very low-rent concert with folding chairs, but the less about that, the better. And then this is a trailer with a twist in it.
Dun, 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 dun. Except dun. I don't think it's a twist.
Well, it's clearly a twist for the sake of this trailer, but yes, I suspect there will be more to the film. If this was the twist for the film, then this is shocking marketing. But yeah, so it turns out that the stadium is being shut down because the police reckon that a serial killer is going to be there. Quite how they found that out, I don't know, but I'm sure we'll find out in the film.
The whole thing has been staged to lure this guy in. Say, for example, the police wanted to find a serial killer who was into Taylor Swift. I don't know.
Okay.
They'd listened to a bunch of podcasts and they were like, this guy is giving off some serious fucking creepy vibes. Let's get Taylor Swift to agree to do a concert, perhaps at Co-op Live, in which case their plans have been discovered.
Yeah.
And then the suspect.
The suspect, yeah.
The unsub.
Gets his tickets.
James, I don't know. Yeah, just to pick a random generic name.
Yeah. You know, I mean, he maybe kills people. He may be the act of dying them. So he calls himself James Dyer because he's dying people.
Because he's dying people, yeah.
And so he could, 2 tickets for James Dyer, please. And then the person goes to the concert and the police ensnare you,
or if you will, they trap him.
Yeah. Ensnare was the working title, I'm guessing. Yeah, but I thought this trailer was great. I don't know why we didn't talk about it last week.
I think we'd done it the week before, if I'm honest. So
there's another twist. But Kobe, I saw a lot of people on Twitter talking about this, saying, I can't believe that they've given away the twist of this movie, which is that Josh Hartnett is the serial killer that they are looking for in the trailer. But that's not the twist of the movie. I imagine there's more twists in the movie.
And you are right.
That's the premise.
I'm sure this is true. But having said that, I do feel that we are living in an age of irresponsible marketing because a number of trailers have launched in the past few weeks, and some of them covering TV shows, we cover them on Pilot, but genuinely have given away almost the entire story of the show, and it is reprehensible.
I feel that Shyamalan would have had some control of this. It's not an expensive film. Yeah, it's not a studio film.
So yeah, exactly.
I think that's as he would have wanted it to go out.
And also, it may not be a twist film.
Mm.
It may not be.
Not all of his films have been in recent
I have
years.
To say, I was watching it and I was thinking, what is this movie? I mean, obviously I'm excited because it's M. Night and, you know, yes, he's still a little bit variable in terms of quality, but when he hits, he, by God, does he hit. And I was like, oh, do I really want to see this movie? It's about a dude bringing his daughter to a concert. Okay, I'm not that on board. Oh, there's a serial killer at the concert. Okay, now I'm intrigued. But the second they reveal in the trailer that the serial killer is Josh Hartnett, and that is beautiful because suddenly you're in there with him from his POV as he is trying to extricate himself from this trap. It is beautiful.
While not upsetting his daughter who's there to see the show.
Precisely.
Exactly. Although, I'll be honest with you, no merch stall attendant has ever been that loquacious in the history of the world. So, no. Also, why would you tell the guy on the merch stand? But anyway.
The entire podcast tour we just did was a trap and you escaped.
It's true.
Damn it.
Kobe, I know when you came in here before we had not much time to record the podcast, you wanted to do a box office prediction game. We might do that at the end if we have time, but that is it for the movie news section right now. Time now for our second guest this week, and it is Winston Duke, who is one of the stars of The Fall Guy this week, which of course stars Ryan Gosling as Colt Seavers. It's a remake of the 1980s Lee Majors TV show about a stunt guy turned bounty hunter. This eschews the bounty hunter part, but has Ryan Gosling's stunt guy get in over his head while shooting a movie down in Australia. The movie is directed by his lady love, or his strange lady love, played by Emily Blunt. And there's lots of stunts and ne'er-do-wells and nefarious goings on and people throwing themselves off buildings and all sorts of stuff. And Winston Duke is the film stunt coordinator and Cole Seaver's best friend. And he attains only a few films into his movie career.
Mm.
And Winston Duke status in this.
Quite right.
Quite rightly so as well. And so that is where I started off on this very fun and very freewheeling chat with Winston Duke, who's a very, very cool, interesting and funny dude. Enjoy.
Welcome to the Emperor Podcast, Winston Duke. How are you, sir?
Really good, man. Really good.
Good, good, good. Or should I say, and Winston Duke,
hey,
which is how you are credited in this movie.
You. Thank you. Yes. Yes,
I
yes.
love an and credit.
Hey, man. The and credits are what you fight for.
It's a big thing. Does it feel different being an and?
You know, I grew up wanting to just be there, but the and really like sets you apart. It's like,
it does.
You know, it makes you, it lets everyone know that, you know, it was a fight to get you and that you're honored. So I felt really good. I felt really good about my and. Yeah.
So this movie's a ton of fun. Mm. Is it, you know, was it, I guess, the archetypal no-brainer?
So, yeah. So, honestly, it was pitched to me. David Leitch called personally and was like, hey, we got this project. And he pitched it by just, first of all, telling me who's already in it. So we've got Emily Blunt, we've got Ryan Gosling. I'm doing it, and this is the idea. It's an action. I understood, you know, the type of movie that we were making. And I was really excited to just jump on board because he's like the king of action at the moment. He's just proven the types of movies that he can make and wants to make and the conversations that he wants to have with audiences. Mm-hmm. That on top of it's going to be a love letter to the stunts community.
Yeah. Yeah,
that on top of, like, we're actually advocating for something super meaningful and we're going to do it disguised as this action movie, right? Yeah. I think what's really powerful about the film as well is that you've truncated some of these really big ideas and these, like, meaningful arguments. And instead of, like, telling you it, mm-hmm. we're going to show you. Yeah. Right? Why it's meaningful. We're going to like add add humanity to it. We're going to create a character that you're going to love and you're going to root for. And he has meaningful things. Like there's that scene where Colt says, all these falls, all these burns, the explosions, the hits, the crashes, they all hurt. Mm-hmm. And I was like, wow. Mm-hmm. Beautifully truncated into one line. Mm-hmm. That tells you that there is human cost, that there is sacrifice mm-hmm. to this gig. Yeah. To making this thing happen, I thought it was just chef's kiss, you know. You know, it was beautiful, and that's what movies are. Movies are they have the ability to turn very intellectual pursuits into just very consumable, like palatable things, and that's what Fall Guy ends up doing. Like you have this full argument about recognition for the stunts community, mm-hmm, and you put it in this.
Yeah.
Beautiful, beautiful vehicle.
Where do you stand on the Oscar debate? That
I think you can tell. Yeah. I think you can tell, right? You can tell. Like, you know, I think what they do is really rooted in so much sacrifice. And I think there's a lot of misdirection. You know, there's a lot of misdirection because we tend to focus on the muscularity and the physicality of stunts, but we forget that it's math, it's physics, mm-hmm. you know, it's numbers. It's mm-hmm. 1 inch to the left, injury. 1 inch to the right, injury.
Wind speed. Yeah, wind all speed. All sorts of things.
Trajectory, yep. momentum. Yep. It's brilliance, right? And it's storytelling made physical. And it's done at such a level that it elevates it to craft. Mm-hmm. It elevates it to art. And every other artistic department is recognized. Why not these guys?
Absolutely.
And then you can't also make the movies that travel the most, that travel the best across the globe are action movies, mm-hmm. movies with these big sequences. Hollywood is built. It's on the backbone of it is the action film. So why not recognize the people who do this sacrifice, who spend equal time away from their families, who have lifelong injuries as a result, who show up and give you a thumbs up? Why
Absolutely.
Not?
Absolutely. So if there were to be an Oscar next year, mm-hmm. and the Fall Guy would undoubtedly be in contention.
Yeah.
What's the stunt that would take on the little gold guy from this movie for you?
Oh, God, I would say, I don't want to spoil anything. Any way you want it, that's the word you need. I would say the scene on the Sydney Harbour Bridge.
Okay.
There's Ryan being pulled, and they actually did that. It's not CGI. I think what's really beautiful as well about this film is that they're really practical stunts. It wasn't a lot of CGI in this. Like, they actually did these things, mm-hmm. right? So they really kind of go back to the roots of filmmaking and the roots of these artistic pursuits by putting flesh on pavement and like putting flesh on in vehicles and mm-hmm. actually having, you know, those high falls for why it's called the Fall Guy, right? Mm-hmm. You know, these high mm-hmm. falls, it really felt like such a beautiful homage. So I think that one, or even just the movie opens with a beautiful fall.
It does. Yeah. An amazing fall. Yeah. And you get involved as well. You get your hands dirty.
My hands are still. I just washed them. You know, still not clean.
Let me check the knuckles, clean. Winston. Are the knuckles okay?
Yeah. So I have to do a lot of my stunts. I did have my own stunt double, and the stunts uh-huh. team worked with me a lot. But I'm almost 6'6" and big, so I still have to step in and do a lot of my own things. I didn't do the falls. I try not to fall on my back too much.
Okay.
But I had to do a lot of my own stunts. And what's beautiful is that, you know, it's a big collaboration with the actor and the stunts team. So you're always getting your hands dirty mm-hmm. in some regard.
So when I'm guessing your first interaction with the stunt department was on Black Panther. Mm. But was there anything that you made before then, and that where you interacted with the stunts crew?
No, not a stunt crew in that regard. Like, I mean, I went through conservatory training.
Yeah.
In graduate school for acting, so we would take things like stage combat and fight combat. Now, on stage, you end up doing a lot more of the choreography than you're.
Oh God! Yeah.
So on stage, you do a lot of the choreography yourself. There might be a stunt coordinator, but it's just one guy. It's not a team. It's just you. There's no takes. So I was very familiar with movement inside of storytelling. You know what I mean? So that was something that I've always enjoyed. But becoming part of Hollywood, everything is just magnified. And that's kind of what happens there. So really working with teams who are looking after you and watching your back. And as much as they're translating these ideas into physical movement, they're also saying no, which is important. They're saying no, that can't be done. No, not without the training. No, not this quickly. No, the sand is too soft.
No, the wind's wrong.
The wind's wrong. Can't do that. And it's really important.
Physics says no.
And you really need those people to do that. Because, like we said, 1 inch to the left, 1 inch to the right, you have injury. Mm-hmm. And on scales like this, scales like what you're seeing back there, if people aren't outside of the blast radius, things aren't calculated the right way, people don't make it home.
Yeah.
So you need integrity.
Yeah.
You need to say no.
Yeah.
You need to be able to advocate and understand that it's not about the capitalism. It's about the humanity.
Yeah, those stockbrokers will have to wait.
Yeah, wait till Fall Guy 2. Yeah, let's train some more. Let's get some more impacted sand. Yeah, let's wait till the wind changes, you know.
Fall Guys.
Yeah, Fall People.
That's the next one.
We've sold it.
Yes, yeah. Hang on, we just sold an idea to Hollywood. I think we
should do a podcast.
Did we just become stockbrokers?
Yeah, we did. Fall People. Yeah.
Capitalism in full effect. You know,
We're always looking.
There's always an angle.
We need sponsors now. Technically, we're not even looking for the idea. We need sponsors.
Gillette.
Yeah.
Fall
Everybody
people.
Grows here. Movies Everyone grows. I like that.
Winston, you've hit upon something because movies don't do that. TV shows do that. You know, you over here, you get Coronation Street brought to you by Cadbury's Dairy Milk.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy brought to you by Gillette. I'm seeing it.
Blows the mind. Yeah. Well, we do have sponsors in movies, actually.
But not in the title.
Wow. You know who's going to make the money, though? We're not going to make the money. The universe is going to make the money, man.
Unless, what? Go with me here. Winston Duke presents The Fall Guy. In association with Gillette.
Not in association.
No, they get in association, but you get presents.
I like that.
You'd have to kick some money in.
Why aren't you like my agent? Why aren't you on the team?
I ask myself this question all the time.
the things that keep you up at night.
Yeah.
Why am I not on Winston Duke's team? 3 a.m, scrolling. Why am I not on Winston Duke's team?
Bolt upright in the middle of the night, screaming, Why?
Why?
Why is Winston Duke not hiring
me? Well, you just did a successful pitch.
I know. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thanks for coming in.
Yeah, no, this has been great. Thanks. My people will be in touch with your people.
I love it.
We'll make it happen. Can you remember the first time you really encountered properly, Len, a stunt team? Let's drag it back to... Was it on Black Panther?
It was Black Panther, which was incredible. Our stunts... So not only was our stunts team great, but the environment. So like Black Panther, because it was a first, it was a number one, it was a lot of prep work. So we actually started prepping. That's probably the most prepping I've done for any action film I've ever done in my life. So we prepped for about 3 to 4 months before we shot. We were just like drilling things, working things, coming up with movements, and then adding culture. So it would be like the Jabari tribe moves this way versus the Panther tribe, the Golden tribe moves versus the Border tribe moves. Adding culture and like the Jabari tribe, what are we going to do? Winston, like, what do you want to do? And I go off and I'll research. I'm like, I'm actually going to work on an Igbo dialect, and I'm actually going to, like, can we incorporate any movements and things like that? So even in Black Panther 2, we were working on this, like, celebratory, and this was a part of the stunts team, the stunts and movements team. We came up with this. So the Jabari tribe were going to do essentially a Jabari haka. Have you ever heard of what hakas are?
I have, yeah, yeah.
So we're going to do what would have felt like a Jabari haka to send the king off to the netherworld, right? Like, you know, for the funeral scene.
Of course.
And we just ran out of time shooting. So, you know, our cutting room floor was probably like 4 or 5 hours of film.
Wow.
For Black Panther 2. And we didn't even get to shoot that haka, right? It just, the day before we're supposed to shoot it, it just got cut. They were like, we have too much stuff to shoot. But we came up with this beautiful haka. It was like the Jabari tribe, and then the Dora Milaje would come in and do their own, like, thing as well. And it, like, we practiced it with, it would be his casket in the middle going through. So,
oh man,
yeah, it was like a whole thing. So the amount of creativity, I think all of this goes back to the amount of creativity that these departments have and come up with, and the amount of translation and storytelling that they infuse into, you know, the storytelling landscape is tremendous. And we just don't, because we're not afforded the process.
No.
You know, the audience isn't afforded the process. So you wouldn't know that the work they do is very akin to the work that these costume folks do, that the scenic design people do, and all that. So special effects, it's the same type of process. So how are they not recognized? It's
incredible.
It's an insult. Yeah. So
it is very much so.
Yeah. So, like, that was my first time really encountering a stunts team, and it's something that stayed with me. And the stunts community is so small that JoJo, one of the main stunts coordinators on Black Panther, was part of this team on Fall Guy, so he knew how I moved. He was very familiar with my body and coming up with, like, ways of, like, having shorthand on coming up with ideas for me. So it's that kind of thing where you do build relationships and you encounter a lot of the same people over and over.
That's beautiful. That's beautiful. I mean, that haka, man, that would have been something.
I have it on my phone. Maybe I'll post it. I'll post it. It's one of those things where, you know, you always wonder if it's the right time to sometimes post some of these things. But yeah, it's been like 2-3 years now since that movie.
Yeah, I guess.
It'd be good to expose people to that. But we pour so much. Like, there's a lot of creativity that goes into these things. And then it just gets truncated down to these 2 hours. But it takes a lot out of these artists' lives, you know.
Absolutely.
All of us. Yeah.
Absolutely. It does. But then, you know, you can maybe use it in the next Black Panther movie, or the emotional investment of the scene, maybe keep it as it was.
I think what it is all the work that you do still imbues and infuses the creative.
Mm.
So it imbues us to the next thing that we do, or the next time we revisit the character in another movie, but they'll never use that thing again.
Mm.
But what it does is the research that I did to come up with that stays with me. That stays in my muscles. That stays in my psyche. That stays in how much I've poured in the bank to draw from in the future. So it's always helpful. It's just sometimes disappointing because, course, you know, sometimes you work so hard on something and it doesn't make it into the movie.
Absolutely.
But at the end of the day, it's just always still additive. So I never feel bad. I'm never upset about when things don't make it in, because I'm always changed, and the character, it's there. It just might be nonverbal.
Last thing I want to ask you before I let you go is, there's a karaoke sequence in this movie.
Boom.
But you do not, I don't want to spoil things for people, you don't get to karaoke.
I am, man.
Dan gets pulled away from the karaoke just as he's about to take the mic.
Man, he was going to, like, give it to him.
What was he going to sing?
actually was going to sing. We actually did it. It's just not in the movie.
Oh,
God. You don't want to see it. I learned a lot about myself in that scene. Shouldn't be singing that song is what I shouldn't be.
What was it?
It was Can We Talk by Tevin Campbell, actually. And see, the thing when you choose a karaoke song is that you also have to remember the octave that the song is in.
Yep, yep.
And that octave is in the octave of a 14-year-old boy, like 14-year-old prepubescent boy. And as much as I love the song, well, the song is not for me. So I was singing at the top, I mean, the top of my register. And I mean, this guy shifts up and I'm like blowing out the pipes. And it was rough. It was rough. Even as a character, I was like, it was very funny. Like everyone was like dying. It was very funny, but it was like, God damn, this is terrible. So it just didn't make it into the movie. It was very funny, but the movie, I think, at one point was supposed to end on Dan finally getting to sing his song. God. But it ends perfectly in every other way.
All right. Well,
that's great.
Maybe one day. Deleted scenes. Absolutely. Well, Winston Duke, star of Winston Duke Presents The Fall Guy in association with Gillette.
Ah, God. Say it again.
Winston Duke Presents The Fall Guy in association with Gillette. The best a man can get.
Oh, my God. That should be my memoirs. Right? The best a man can get. The Winston Duke story. Brought to you by Gillette. Yeah.
Brought to you by Gillette. Absolutely. It's been a pleasure, sir. Thank you so much indeed.
So good, man.
Thank you. That was great.
Blessings. Thank you. Fantastic.
Okay, that was Winston Duke, and now it's time to talk about The Fall Guy. Hell's Bells.
Yes, hello.
You're the Fall Girl on this
one. Okay. Yes, so Ryan Gosling plays a stuntman who, when we meet him, is on top of the world. He's just gotten together with Jodie, Emily Blunt's character. The two of them are like madly in love. Everything looks rosy, and then he has a terrible accident and is really knocked back on his heels, and everything goes a bit to pot. So we rejoin the story, a year and a half later?
Yeah, 18 months.
And at this point, Jodie is directing her first film, and he gets a call from the producer, played by Hannah Waddingham, saying, the star has gone missing. You need to come down here and basically help us out. And he is called back into action and he can't resist it because basically it's all about getting Jodie back for him.
Indeed. And this is the star played by Aaron Taylor-Johnson, that he is the regular stunt double for.
Exactly. And has been for many, many years. Yeah. And Winston Duke, as you said, is the stunt coordinator on this film within a film. His best friend who kind of gets him back into action because Jodie can't know that the star is missing. She might freak out.
No.
So they have to keep everything rolling along. It's a lot of fun. I had an absolute blast with this. This is a film that, I mean, when you think about it for more than a millisecond, doesn't make a lick of sense. None of the story is really sensible. You know, it's sort of, follow this convenient clues to this place because of reasons, and none of it holds up. Doesn't matter. This coasts along beautifully on big, stupid stunts and movie star chemistry and charisma. And in those, it delivers in spades. And, you know, there is literally a montage. Do stay through the end credits. There's a montage of them doing all the stunts and them showing you how much they tried to do practically on the film, which is pretty cool. But, like, it's just kind of like action scene. It felt like every 5-6 minutes and lots of kind of quipping and grinning at each other in between. And sometimes that's absolutely all I want or need from a summer blockbuster. I had a great time with this.
And we should say, of course, this is directed by David Leitch.
Yes.
The latest in his string of post-John Wick. It's fascinating, the road that he has taken and the road that Chad Stahelski has taken after John Wick, because Chad Stahelski has just immersed himself deeper and deeper in the world of Wick. And David Leitch has gone, I'm just going to have fun.
Bullet Train!
I'm going to make Bullet Train. I'm going to make Atomic Blonde. Okay,
Hobbs and Shaw.
Hobbs and Shaw, Deadpool 2, and now this. Yeah. And this is a love letter to stunts. He is a stunty. Is David Leitch, and that shows.
It does, absolutely. The one thing I would say, though, that it is that the stunt team within the film, like as an on-screen stunt team, behave wildly irresponsibly, and that is not... it's in some ways a very bad representation, I think, actually, of stunt teams, because they just keep rolling up and going, yeah, we'll just do that, great. And there's been no rehearsal, there's been no, like, breakdown of risk, there's been no mitigation.
Pyrotechnics are going off left, right, and
centre. Yeah, and they're just like, woo!
Doesn't matter. Hey, have fun.
So in that sense, it's a very bad tribute to some people, but in every other sense, it's a lot of fun.
I enjoyed it. I had a big grin on my face all the way through. I wasn't laughing loud all the way through. But Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt, two of my favourite people on screen at the moment. It's good to see Hannah Waddingham in something out, you know, on the big screen. Is this her first time in the film?
I don't know. I'm sure she's been in stuff before, but post Ted Lasso, then this is, you know, kind of her first big thing that isn't Eurovision.
Yeah.
Oh, the Olivier, she hosts that as well.
And do you guys actually remember the Fall Guy TV show?
I do.
Of course. Lee Majors.
I do.
No, because for me it was like top tier was A-Team.
Yeah.
Knight Rider.
Airwolf.
Yep. Second tier was Airwolf. Airwolf was second tier.
You were saying earlier on that you're younger than us and you're remembering all the same
Street
shows.
Street Hawk was C tier.
Yeah. And that's where I'd put Fall Guy. So it's good to make, I think it's good to have a film that's about something that not a lot of people remember that fondly. It just, I really want a lot more from it because...
It's written by Drew Pearce as well.
Yeah. So who good writer.
Co-wrote Hobbs and Shaw for David Leitch also. And of course wrote my beloved Iron Man, co-wrote with Shane Black, my beloved Iron Man 3. And this feels a little bit like a Shane Black movie that every now and again has stunts erupt into it. It feels like Kiss Kiss, bang, bang.
I think that's the biggest problem with it though. Because I think when you go, and don't get me wrong, I think Drew Pearce is generally a great writer. I think this did have Shane Black vibes to it, not least of all because obviously Ryan Gosling is in it, so it echoed The Nice Guys slightly in with this kind of noirish sort of murder subplot. But The Nice Guys being a Shane Black movie is incredibly well written with extraordinary dialogue. And I felt, again, Drew Pearce, great writer, I just felt that the dialogue wasn't really there and the story was slightly incoherent and a little bit silly at times. I think Carolyn's absolutely right. This gets by on star power. I think Emily Blunt is brilliant. I think Ryan Gosling is brilliant. I do think they carry the film and they do a lot of heavy lifting. I enjoyed myself, don't get me wrong. I did enjoy this film, but I didn't think it was very good either.
The sheer charisma, though, of Gosling in particular, because I get the impression with Blunt that she didn't, that the role wasn't worthy of her whenever she signed on and they must have punched it up, I'm guessing. Yeah. But even so, she's not really involved in the main plot. This is very much, we're following this guy as he goes on this detective's journey and he's a bit of an incompetent detective but a brilliant stuntman. And so that's where a lot of the comedy lies. But because Gosling is in, I don't know, he's in this kind of almost nuclear-powered charisma phase of his career, it's really quite something to watch. He is very much, if you watch his career, he's been very much an amazing actor right from the off, but he's been someone who was kind of, I don't know, a little bit wary of stuff like that, very serious in his career,
you know, and self-serious maybe a little bit, and that's all
and his
gone.
Choices were serious,
yeah,
and really like things like Blue Valentine and The Place Beyond the Pines and movies like that. And now he's going, you know what, I'm going to be a movie star.
Fuck
and
it,
I'm going to own it. I'm going to have fun. And he's the principal reason, I think, why you should see this movie.
100%. He's the main driver behind all of it and everything that's going on there. He's, every time he's on screen, he's such a great guy. I wish the chemistry was slightly better between him and Emily. I think that's probably what James is talking about with the scripting. I feel it didn't pull me in as much as I'd want it to.
I think they have a problem that they're trying to keep them apart to give the romantic story some tension.
Yeah.
But then that means you don't get as much of them interacting as you want because them interacting is great, you know?
Yeah. Some scenes are hilarious in there, but I feel like I'm down beating on it, but I really had a huge grin on my face all the way through the film. Maybe it's a bit too long, maybe it's part of the factor there, but these two together on screen, Ryan Gosling, and look, David Leitch has got a fantastic back catalogue, and I think I'm just excited to see whatever else he has, you know, out going forward.
Whatever he does, yeah.
And fair play to the stunt team who did literally break records for car roles and stuff on this film. So fair play. Really, it was worth it.
4 stars then for The Fall Guy. Next up, Love Lies Bleeding. Kobe?
So this follows Kristen Stewart as Lou, who is a gym manager. And the story starts when we get Katie M. Bryan's character, Jackie, who steps into the area as she's on the way to take part in the bodybuilding contest in Las Vegas. Those guys meet and have a few dalliances and fall in love. But in the background, there's a lot of bad shit happening in the family and around the area. And they both get involved in it and some dark things. Follow up to, as we talked about, St. Maud. I think Rose Glass is pretty much making films that will freak me out. Say more, actually freak me out in many different ways. I couldn't mm-hmm. actually go to sleep mm-hmm. so, the night after that.
Drawing pins.
I'm like, that's quite, that is actually probably the worst, isn't it?
Welsh people.
Oh, shocking.
And this, what's going on?
And this film goes to those kind of places as well. And she has those moments, and her directorial style kind of extrapolates the internal thoughts and makes them manifest in real life. And that comes in extraordinary ways in this film. I think it's astonishing. It's really something. I wish I'd seen it with a crowd. I think it would have been really great to see that, see all those things play out there. Ed Harris in this, his hairstyle is...
Oh my God. Terrifying.
That on its own is offensive and haunting.
This is a man who's gone Nutkins plus. Like,
he has Terry Nutkins.
Next level.
Oh, there we go. That's how old we are. We're
really wild.
Terry Nutkins, yeah.
It's a bit like Hulk Hogan, brother.
Yeah, it really is. Like, oh, it's extraordinary.
A little bit Mick Miller if I want to age myself even more. But you don't see people rocking that hairstyle anymore.
Not enough.
Completely bald and two-thirds of your scalp and then just growing it out long in the Billy Ray Cyrus style-y at the back. Like, so it's a mullet, but there's nothing on top.
The Picard mullet.
Precisely. Picard
mullet, yeah. Oh, no.
James, if you grew your hair out, I think
how much would you
pay me? Could... attain that.
And also, how long would it take me to get to the Ed Harris length?
It's years.
I'd say decades.
I need to really commit to this for about 5 or 6 years if I wanted to do it.
I mean, look, your dating life isn't going well
I'm doing it starting today.
Look, mullets are coming back. Maybe that style is coming
back.
Maybe
that's it. Maybe that's it.
That style has never been to come back.
I'll update my Hinge profile.
Oh, God.
Oh yeah, what do you guys think? You guys have both seen.
Do you know what? I just want to say, like, I do think I'm fascinated to hear what you think about the. So there is a magical realism aspect to this film, which I wonder whether it will lose some people, because like when you have magical realism and you lay it throughout a film, I think people build up a tolerance and acceptance of it. This film uses it so sparingly that when it does lapse into fantasy, it fucking blindsides you.
Sure.
And you're just like, oh my God, what is happening? And there are two very specific ones, and you're obviously not going to say what they are, but. It's a lot, right? Like, I mean, did you have that sort of almost like double take feeling?
Almost. Like, you're like, wait, am I seeing what I think? Oh, no, I am. Oh, okay, that's happening.
This
All right.
is happening.
And it is a very strange film in many ways, but it's also really, it's really interesting. It's a kind of relationship between two kinds of characters that we almost never see. I mean, not even aside from the fact that it's a queer relationship, just like you don't see... people who are as weird and fucked up as these two in the particular ways that they're weird and fucked up very often on screen. And that is really, I mean, there's elements obviously of that, like things like the wrestler and just kind of that kind of body abuse in the pursuit of perfection kind of ideas in this. The Iron Claw, I guess, delved into that quite recently.
Brother.
But there's also just so much gnarliness and kind of compromise and secrets and just emotional violence and emotional confusion
and actual violence.
A lot of actual violence.
Body horror.
Yeah. And I think that's, we don't see this particular combination of these ingredients very much. It's a really singular film, which makes it really hard to kind of judge in some ways, because you're like, am I just blown away by how weird this is? Or, you know, what do I think of it as itself? And I liked it. I did like it, but I wasn't as totally blown away as I was by Saint Maud, which I think is an astonishing film. I think this is a very good film. But I will watch it again at some point, because maybe once I've had a rest.
You have to watch it again.
Yeah. Just because I think it does do some extraordinary things.
It's an audacious bit of filmmaking.
Yeah.
It definitely won't be for everyone.
Definitely not.
And it's not Saint Maud at all. Mm-mm. But it has the same kind of sense of pushing boundaries and doing different things and exploring areas that we don't see that often. And also gnarliness that makes you squirm.
So much.
A lot of that in there too.
Boom. Sold. 25 tickets to Challengers and Love Lies Bleeding, please. There's one for me, one for my mate Chewbacca, one for Kofi, one for Buddy the Elf, of course.
Oh, God.
Oh, my word.
Everyone join in.
Oh, my word. 4 stars, I believe. 4 stars?
Yes.
Yes, 4 stars then for Love Lies Bleeding. Next up is a rom-com. This is where James lives. A rom-com starring Anne Hathaway. This is where I live. It's called The Idea of You, James.
It is.
I do love a rom-com, although I will say, like, on the spectrum of rom-coms, obviously there are ones that slide more towards the com, and I'd say this slides very much the other way. This, for me, I would just call it a romance.
It's
I wouldn't
just
even
a romance,
call it
yeah.
a rom-com at all, because there are literally no jokes in it. So that's not to say, like, tone, it's not like heavy tone, but it's not funny, and it doesn't try to be funny. So this is directed by Michael Showalter, and it's based on the novel by Robin Lee, and the basic setup of this is Anne Hathaway is a single mother, she's divorced, and her daughter, especially going to Coachella with her ex-husband. He flakes out, fuck with who he is. And so she is forced to take her daughter and her friends to Coachella. And in one of the more interesting meet-cutes I've seen, she runs into one of the band members from the band August Moon, which is the big boy band of the era. And she runs into him in a toilet, as you do. And a certain frisson.
A frisson.
Is detected. And essentially this then, she's 40. And he's 24.
What?
So it's the whole... This is kind of a...
I know, he's too old for her.
Do you know what I mean? So it's very much taking a poke at that sort of like the fact that... Well, indeed.
Less come
of that
on now.
On screen, although there's a bit of that. It's taking an idea of the fact that, you know, were she a man, no one would bat an eyelid. But obviously, because she's a woman, everyone's like, cougar, cougar, cougar. And it becomes a whole thing about whether or not she can have a love affair with someone who is, A, that much younger than her, but also is... absolutely epically massively famous. So it deals with the celebrity aspects of it as well.
And he is played by?
And he is played, in fact, by Nicholas Galitzine, who you might have seen in Mary and George.
Red, White, and Royal Blue.
Royal Blue.
Yeah.
Okay.
He's less cock out in this one. So, you know.
The cock out was in Mary and George.
Yes.
Not in Red, White, and Royal Blue.
Well, not in the cut that I saw. No. But genuinely, I really like the way this is done. And I think some of the commentary this makes is quite subtle. Like, I like the fact that Galitzine's character, Hayes Campbell, the boy band guy, he's kind of a cipher early on. Like, he's pretty and famous. And that's all you really need to know about him, in the same way that you can very much imagine a rom-com drawing a female character in this regard, which I thought was really nicely done. Whereas I think Hathaway's character is incredibly nuanced and there's a lot more going on with her and how she navigates both, you know, the age gap, her own role as a parent, the fame aspects of it as well.
Fame.
It's really interesting. And actually, it's quite a nice romantic film.
It's just a nice film.
It's a well-done adaptation of this book, I think.
See, Helen.
The rumor is that the book was basically originally Harry Styles fan fiction.
Yeah.
And the problem is, like,
in
when
the same
you
way
meet...
Fifty Shades of Grey began life as Twilight fan
exactly. fiction. Exactly. And the problem with that is, like, you're literally looking at this dude in his endless fluffy cardigans and thinking, yep, I see it. I can see it. It's definitely on somebody's mind. And it's just quite hard to escape. And the other thing is, you know, the problem, I think, with this as a matter of kind of wish fulfillment for its purported audience is like a 40-year-old woman who looks like Anne Hathaway kind of just equals a 30-year-old woman. Do you know what I mean? So there's no aspect of kind of wish fulfillment in
she
here.
She does, like, not look 40.
Hollywood has not learned this. The lesson of, you know,
life.
Dirty Dancing, which is that you put an even slightly normal-looking woman in your rom-com can actually be a good thing to do. Putting this luminous creature in, I think, kind of takes away from some of the stuff that the film is trying to say.
Now, because it's very much, how did he manage to pull
it? It kind of is. Like, even as a 24-year-old pop star, you're like,
I mean, he's a
good-looking
guy.
He's a good-looking... He doesn't look his best in this film, I would say.
Oh, really?
But anyway, but yeah, he's a good-looking guy. But I just genuinely couldn't get past the fact that she is so much better looking than anyone else on screen. You're just like, what is the hang up here, guys? And yes, I get that, you know, even if it were somebody that absolutely gorgeous, that you would still get all the internet hate and you would still get all the tabloid headlines. I understand that. And it has happened that way in reality. I understand. But I did just, I really did trip over that a little bit because I feel like it does take away, I think, from some of what the film is trying to do and certainly some of what its audience is looking for in it.
I thought you might, because earlier on, just before we started recording, we were going, okay, who's talking about what this week? All right, Helen, you could do Fall Guy. Kobe, you do Love Lies Bleeding. James, you'll do The Idea of You. And Helen looked at me and held up four fingers for the idea of you and then just shook her head.
Like, I'm not, it's not terrible, and it's far better than I expected it to be. I want to be clear on that. It's not terrible.
Yeah.
But I personally was nowhere near four stars.
I was
on this.
Surprised it got 4 stars. Like, I had a really good time. I probably had a 4-star experience with it, but this falls in my sort of romantic comedy sweet spot. And I love that juxtaposition of people from different worlds. I like the fame thing. You know, it's the whole Notting Hill sort of star-crossed.
Oh, you love that shit.
I very much enjoy this stuff. Yeah, 4 was interesting. That said, I think I would probably more easily give this 4 than I would give The Fall Guy 4, which I was as baffled by that getting 4 stars as you were baffled by this getting 4 stars.
I know, so. I'm 100% easy 4 on that one.
So 3-4 stars this week. I'd give 4.
3-4 stars?
Yeah.
And you know,
at least one of those deserves them.
And they're all of a different stripe. You know, you can see The Fall Guy in the cinema, you can see Love Lies Bleeding in the cinema, and you can watch The Idea of You at home because it's on Prime Video. And you know what? I think apart from the dreadful adverts being shunted into a film without warning at the most inopportune moments, which is what they're doing these days, I think a lot of people are going to, you know, I think it's going to be big on sofas this week. Oh,
I will say, yes. One thing, and without giving anything away, the ending of this film
is different.
Is excellent.
And do you think?
Yeah, I thought the ending was
excellent. We're going to have to talk about that.
Really liked the ending.
Sounds like we're doing The Idea of You spoiler special.
That's what I think. Yeah.
Bring it on.
Oh, yeah. We'll do a Bring It On spoiler special as well. Fuck it. I don't care.
Let's do it. I'll bring the pom-poms.
All right. 4 stars then for The Idea of You. We haven't been kicked out. We have not been kicked out. So I'm going to, until we get kicked out, Kobe, let's play this summer prediction box office game type thing that you were wanting to play. Do you want to quickly explain what it is and then we'll play it as best as we can?
Yeah, absolutely. So every summer, there's another film podcast that's not Flixwatch.
There's another film podcast? Don't be ridiculous.
Fuck.
I know. I was astonished.
Come in here, you piss on our rug.
Oh my God.
It's the third one, I think, that exists. Maybe there's a Cinemal as well. They're there.
Oh, we love them. They can live.
So these guys, David Chen, Jeff Kanata, and Devendra Hardwar, every year they select a date where the summer movies start and finish and try to predict the order of them in terms of US and Canadian box office.
And this week is the beginning of the summer movie season.
Exactly,
with The
Fall Guy. Okay. And it ends on the 2nd of September with films.
Okay, you've done the research. I like it.
So it's like, it's essentially like the kind of fantasy football league for films and just trying to predict where you think they're going to lie.
Yeah.
So it's kind of more complicated than that on their website. But
I like that you haven't said the name of the podcast so people can't find it. Do not say the name of the podcast.
You guys know if you know it.
If you know, you know.
I thought I brought it to Chris and he thought, yeah, son of a bitch, I'm in.
You son of a bitch. Because some damn fool accused you of being the best summer box office prognosticator. All right. So they're really in depth. I mean, they go through it and they want you to pick things in order and
we simply do not have time.
We don't have time or the wherewithal to do that. So we're not going to get in depth. Mm-hmm. But what I think we should do, maybe we should talk very, very quickly, about what we think is going to win the summer box office?
Sure.
I would have said that there's a correct answer to this particular question.
Yeah.
The one that's going to win quite clearly is Despicable Me 4.
That's
segment.
Really?
I don't think it's even going to be close.
No, I don't think so either.
I mean, my heart says Deadpool Wolverine.
I think that's going to do really well.
And 1, 2, 3, Deadpool Wolverine, Inside Out 2, Despicable Me 3. That's what I'm thinking in my head.
I love Inside Out 2. I think it's going to do very well.
Yep.
I don't think it's going to do as well as Despicable Me 4, which didn't the last one do a billion?
Yep.
It did.
Which
it did.
The last Inside Out did not.
No.
But I think.
It's depressing, but this is 100% going to win.
Having said that, you know, Captain Marvel made a billion and then the Marvels made 200 million.
True.
Aquaman made a billion and then the sequel made 400 million. So it's not a guarantee anymore.
It is not. But
that said, my top 3 for the summer is also Despicable Me 4, Inside Out 2, and Deadpool and Wolverine. I think those are the only 3 that have a shot at even getting close to a billion,
mm-hmm.
because obviously the market is changing and shrinking and retracting and doing all sorts of
things. What did the previous Deadpools do box office-wise?
700 million each, roughly.
Okay.
Thereabouts. No X-Men movie has ever hit $1 billion. Which, you know, which is surprising because a lot of people think, oh, this is like
Yeah, you'd think at least Days injection. Of Future Past, but no, not even. No.
I think Days of Future Past is the biggest one. They got close to about 800 million. 800, or thereabouts. And it's not the guaranteed injection of cash into the MCU this summer, but I think it will be huge. Against that, it's R-rated. You know, very rare for an R-rated film to hit a billion.
Yeah.
I think it will be despicable
me. But if Joker can do it, my beloved Wolverine deserves it.
Absolutely.
The Return of Wolverine, I'm just speaking from my heart here, guys. Everyone go and watch this film because I want to win this.
You're not going to.
Trailer's really good. We'll all go. You'll go. We'll go. Buddy will be there. Chewbacca will be there. We'll load up those fucking chimichangas and we're going to have
gonna be great.
A ton of fun.
Circle jerk of life.
When Despicable Me 4 comes out, my small nephew and his entire class will be there. Do you know what I mean? I don't know if we can compete with them. Minions.
You can't compete against the Minions.
Never bet against the Minions.
Someone dressed in yellow and blue will win the box office this summer.
That's for sure.
Joy is yellow and blue. You've just covered all bases. Joy is yellow and blue.
Have you
Wolverine.
Not met Chris?
This ain't my first rodeo. Very clever. But very, very quickly, because there are some movies out there. I don't know. Like they're saying that The Fall Guy is going to make around 30 to maybe 40 million at the box office. That's not a great start.
I think it's going to do a little bit better than that this weekend. But I also think it has probably a bigger female audience than they're counting at the moment.
It is a romance.
Tracking.
It is a romance.
And women come out slower, as it were, than men do.
It may have legs. It may have lovely legs. Not that... they all have lovely bottoms.
They all have lovely legs. They're all lovely girls.
They all have lovely bottoms.
Oh, God.
But what do we think the likes of Furiosa? Quickly, Furiosa?
700?
You think
I think it's still less.
You're probably right. Yeah. I'm being optimistic.
Okay, but Dune Part 2 did about 200 million more than the first one. So,
Still.
Yeah, but Dune was a special thing.
Yes, wasn't it just?
Furiosa is a special thing.
Furiosa is a special thing. And I'm interested that they've this week started the publicity push for it with War Boys on the Sydney Harbour Bridge. I think they're going to push that one pretty hard. So.
All right. Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes, James?
No.
Don't care.
No.
Okay. Kobe, what else? What's your dark horse?
So I've got one Bad Boys Ride or Die that's going to be in the mix.
Yeah, that's going to be big. It is.
It might.
Last one made $400 million. This one's going to do more.
If it was called Bad Boys for Life, then definitely it would have taken the top spot.
That's right.
Without question.
That one is going to be big. By 500 million, I'm saying.
Other ones,
I think three.
Other ones in interest to watch are Twisters.
I'm excited about Twisters. But I may be alone in this. I admit.
I'm excited about it as well. And also, I don't have no idea what Alien Romulus is going to be like.
I don't think that's going to do well.
No.
I'll be honest with you.
Neither do I, but I wish it would.
But there you go. We shall see. Come back at the end of the summer, Kobe. Come down from Manchester. From up north. And assuming, of course, that the Co-op Live, which is where I presume you all live, has opened by that point, you can come down and see how we all fared.
I'm genuinely worried. I'm going to see Eric Clapton there mid-May. And I don't know if that's going to happen.
No. You're going to go to the AO Arena to see Eric Clapton. All right. On that note, that is it for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun. We'll be joined by... Josh O'Connor. He's bloody everywhere.
Hello.
And he's a star of La Chimera, which is a fantastic Italian movie in which he speaks Italian pretty much all the way through. Take that, Duolingo. I no idea what you just said, but I'm offended. We'll also be joined by Michael... Hey, Superman. We'll also be joined by Michael Lindsay-Hogg, who is the director of Let It Be, which has been released on Disney Plus 54 years after its initial release back in 1970. And there may be someone else knocking around on that episode as well because, it's me. All right. But until we meet again, until then, until that auspicious occasion, it is goodbye from my three colleagues of such lethal cunning, the best box office prognosticators in the business, except no other substitutes. Helen O'Hara, goodbye.
Toodaloo.
Kobe Omanaka, goodbye.
Ciao.
James Dyer, I love your back mullet.
Thank you, Chris. Jennifer Connelly is on the Pilot TV podcast. We're talking about dark matter, so do come and listen to us there.
That's good. Well done. Well done, Jennifer Connelly. Excellent stuff. All right, and it's goodbye from me as well. I'm off to write next week's podcast introduction and put it on Twitter for premium subscribers only. Thanks so much for listening. See you next time. Bye-bye.